Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I just want to say, yes, we're here and talking to you live. So that's going to be part of the agenda here on the program, is talking to you live and taking your emails. But before we go any further, let me just remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of this speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, there were a great many interesting things in the news this week and some good emails, but I want to just throw this one out. This was a recent poll about healthcare, and you know, it depends on how you ask the question. So here's how it goes. You hear a lot from the Republican Party and the Tea Party how many Americans disapprove of the healthcare reform bill, but it doesn't actually tell you why they disapprove. Well, this poll actually looked at exactly why don't you like the healthcare reform that went through Congress. And what they found was that 4 out of 10 people don't like it because they don't think it did enough. They think that it was disappointing because it didn't provide universal coverage, because it doesn't really reform healthcare in the way that it so badly needs to be reformed. About 1 out of 5 or 2 out of 10, in other words, half as many don't like it because they don't want government involved in healthcare. Well, that works out to 6 out of 10 people who don't like it, which matches the statistics. But why they don't like it? Well, let's just say that they're not unified in their opinion. Let's go to an email. This one from Nick in Santa Cruz. And Nick writes, I was punched in the nose in a fight and it bled profusely until I stopped it with a tissue. I'm concerned because I can flex the middle part that divides the nostrils way further in one direction than the other. And I can feel with my fingers in my nose that it bends on a sharp angle one way and not the other. I'm wondering if you can break nose cartilage. It doesn't hurt, but it feels kind of like that area of my nose is bruised. Should I be worried? And if so, what can I do without seeing a doctor? And I'm assuming that Nick doesn't want to go to a doctor because, like so many people, he doesn't have health insurance and it's going to cost him a lot of money out of pocket. Well, that's one of the reasons I'm here. Although I can't practice medicine over the radio, I can certainly tell you, yes, this sounds like you need a doctor, or no, this sounds like they're going to pat you on the head and say, there, there. And Nick, this is category number 2 for you. Yes, it sounds like you've cracked the cartilage in your nose and you may end up with what we call a deviated septum. And that can cause you trouble down the line, but basically it's going to cause you trouble or it's not going to cause you trouble. And when you fix that trouble really won't matter. So here's the scoop. Ice it. You've probably got a hematoma, which is a collection of blood in the septum, and the septum itself, which is that flexible piece of cartilage between the two nostrils that divides the airways, is bent. Cartilage does bend, kind of like a rigid polystyrene plastic or something. It can bend, but it usually doesn't break or shatter the way bone does. It's more flexible than that. It can be bent back, but generally speaking, that isn't what we do when people show up with this sort of injury. We let the bruising go down. We let the swelling go down, and then we see whether or not the airway on one side is narrowed so much that we need to bend it back. And if that has to be done, it can be done early or it can be done late. So delay in this case doesn't cost you much in terms of outcome. So I would say conservative management at this point, and down the line when healthcare reform kicks in, which, let's see, in 2012 or maybe 2014, depending on your personal circumstances, you'll be able to get your nose fixed. Woohoo! Unless, of course, the Republicans win this fall, and then who knows? Sorry, I don't mean to make fun, but I have to. You know, it's gallows humor, because with the situation that we have in our society, you either laugh or you cry. And, you know, crying's bad for your immune system, so laugh away. Now we're going to go to our first caller, and that is Samantha in Marina. Hello, Samantha, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thanks so much for doing this. I just wanted to ask you about your little, I don't know if it was just a throwaway, but you said crying's bad for the immune system, and I always thought crying, as long as you, like, get it all out and move on, is really good.
Well, I guess what I meant is despair is bad for the immune system. So in the case of healthcare and the ongoing tragedy that unfolds daily before my lives of people who are either receiving far more care than they rationally should get because there's funding, or people who are receiving no care when they really need it because there's no funding, that leads to despair. That leads to crying every day. That leads to the darkness in my soul, if I let it. So that kind of crying is bad for the immune system. If when you talk about crying, if you're talking about just purging yourself of negative feelings, crying and then feeling better and going on, that's a different thing.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. All right. So well, thank you for getting me to clarify. Bye-bye.
And your speech made me want to give, even though I've given it the annual, you know, like 120 level, and that's, you know, really what I can afford, but I wanted to give more just because of your wonderful speech, and thank you guys.
Well, thank you. And, you know, if you can afford more, even though you might be someone who pledged last spring, if there was ever a moment to make a little bonus gift to the station, this would be that moment. So thank you. And we had another off-air question. Are there any disadvantages to eating raw vegetables such as carrots or broccoli? That really depends upon the health of your digestive tract and your teeth. Because the only issue with raw vegetables really is that because they're raw, the cell walls are still pretty tight and hard, and it takes a fair amount of work to break them down and get to the nutrition that's inside the cell walls. So raw vegetables need to be chopped or chewed well, and you need to have good digestive enzymes. That means adequate levels of hydrochloric acid and good pancreas function. And while that's, for most people, a given, as you get older, it's more and more likely that that becomes a problem. So in general, a raw vegetable diet for someone over 60 is iffy. For someone who is needing to use any kind of heartburn medication, also very iffy. Otherwise, I think it's fine, and I hope that's clarified that question. Let's go to Will in Scotts Valley. Hello, Will, and welcome to the program.
I have a question. I always forget to bring it to the attention of my doctor when I go in because it doesn't cause any discomfort. What has happened is I'm losing body hair. Hair on my chest, underarm,
yep,
is practically all gone, and on my legs also. And I'm wondering whether it's a nutritional deficiency, signs of old age, or some other problem.
Interesting question. Let me give you the two answers. I'll put on my white coat first and give you the white coat answer, and then I'm going to take out my kimono and my acupuncture needles and give you the Chinese medicine answer. Well, I guess I should, kimonos don't work for Chinese medicine, but you get the point. So white coat answer is that what's happening as you age, particularly males, but also females, is that you make less testosterone. And testosterone is necessary for hair growth. So as your testosterone drops, you have less hair, and that's top of your head, also the rest of your body. That's one reason. Nutritionally, there's not a lot you can do about that. Assuming that you're not deficient in protein, then there isn't much you can do to get that hair back. Some people say that biotin can help with hair strength, but I don't think it makes the hair grow back more profusely. At least I don't think there's any data to suggest that. Now, taking off my white coat and putting on my acupuncture garments, I will now say that what is happening is that your supply of life force jing, which is stored in your kidneys, has become depleted with age. And this is a natural phenomenon. And there are tonification herbs and things that support the kidneys that can help with this. But what's most important is that you get plenty of sleep and not push your body. What this is an indication that you don't have a lot of reserve left. If you push yourself, you will become even more depleted and quite possibly get sick with something, you know, drastic. Okay?
Actually, my beard has not changed. I mean, even, you know, on my neck and everything, I have a very full beard. And it has pretty much remained the same, which seems very odd.
Very paradoxical. And I don't have an explanation for you.
Okay. But nothing to worry about anyway. I haven't worried about it.
No.
I don't think so.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Dee in Salinas. Hello, Dee, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling. I have an adult daughter who has been wanting flu shots, and And she has gone for many years to see about getting a flu shot, and they will not give her one because she is allergic to eggs.
What's the nature of her allergy?
Eggs.
No, I mean, does she get hives? Does she wheeze?
Oh, no. Almost nausea, but not quite. She just feels terrible and has a sulfur taste for about 24 hours.
Okay.
They just will not give her the flu shot, and she just would like to have one sometime.
Right, right. And I understand why they're reluctant, and what I can tell you how what she needs to do to fix this. Okay?
Good.
All right. So first, the flu virus is grown on eggs, and so if you have anaphylaxis, which is to say you wheeze, you get hives, you go into shock when you eat eggs, we would not want you to have the flu shot because it might conceivably have enough egg protein left over, not purified out, to trigger an anaphylactic response. The problem is, it sounds like what your daughter has is actually egg intolerance. She doesn't digest them well, or she has local antibodies in her gut against the protein. This is really not dangerous. If she wheezed or had asthma or hives when she got eggs, then I would be worried. The problem is the word allergy is ambiguous in this setting. So now that she officially has told everybody that she's allergic to eggs, and I want to also just say bravo to the people who are giving the flu shot for asking, because you're supposed to ask every single person, have you ever had an allergic reaction to eggs? What she needs to do now is prove that she's not allergic to eggs in that way. And she could go to an allergist. If she has health insurance, she can get this done. And she can be skin tested for egg protein. They'll scratch her arm and they'll put a little bit of egg protein extract on there. And they'll scratch her arm in another place and put a neutral compound that's just the base, the liquid without the egg protein in it. And then when she doesn't have a hive from the egg protein, she can get a little card from the allergist saying this person does not have an egg allergy, and off we go.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Hopefully someday soon we'll have flu vaccine that isn't grown on eggs, and that'll take care of the problem for a lot of people.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. Let's take one more call. That's David in Salinas. Hello, David. How are you?
Yeah, great show, Dr. Don. Listen, I've got a financial question. My wife and I are going to dump our health insurance. We can't pay for it. $860 a month for emergency care only is not a winner. And in the past, I have paid cash for blood tests and doctor's appointments and so on. And I'm supposed to get the better rate. I'm supposed to get the insurance rate, and I don't. It's a rip. No, I went to the dermatologist. I said I wanted to pay cash, and they said, okay, it's $350.
Did you know that in the doctor's contract with Blue Cross, it says that if somebody wants to pay cash and you don't charge them your list price, if you give them a deal, then you've just broken your contract with Blue Cross and they'll sue you?
So I can bring that up.
That's my point. The point is they have to do it under the table if they're going to do it at all. They can't do it out in the open. Because were they to do this in the open to, let's say, a representative of Blue Cross who's just testing the waters to make sure that you're compliant with your contract, you know, realistically, all that the health plans have to sell is this discount. Now that they've got the big copays and very high premiums, people are paying so much for their health insurance that discount is the only thing keeping everybody from walking away. So they're really enforcing that leveraged discount. We live in a culture of fear as doctors, I have to tell you. You know, it seems like somebody, either the government or the lawyers or the health plan, is coming after me every day for something that I'm supposed to have control over. Sorry, I'm big, you know, world's smallest violin, like my life is that bad. But anyway, you know, that's the situation. So I guess here's my advice on your situation. You need to pre-negotiate with the office manager, and you don't do it at the front desk. You get to know people, and they get to know that you're not working for Blue Cross, that, you know, you kind of identify yourself and are the guy who does gardening. You know, you've got the truck with the landscaping sticker on it. You're not a shill for, and let's pick another insurance company, Anthem, you know, because it's not any one of them that's so terrible. They're all companies, and they're trying to make profit. Anyway, to get back to your situation, you can pre-negotiate, and the other thing you can do is you can buy the service, and then you can go back later on after you're delinquent and talk to the business office rather than send you to collections where they'll completely lose things. Most business offices will work out a reduced price for you. But it's better to do it ahead of time through the business office rather than okay. late. Okay? And as far as negotiating with the labs, good luck. That's a real tough one. There are labs that are, you know, if you go online, you can find labs out of state where you can send your blood. They're mostly based in Florida, which has different laws. You can send your blood to them, and then they will run the tests, and you prepay for the tests, and it's maybe 30%, 25-30% of the list price with the local labs.
All right, that's good to know.
So, you know, and those are available online. You can find labs. Life Extension Foundation is one, and they're pretty decent.
Well, very good, very
okay.
good.
All right, good luck.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Vaughn.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a little pause now, and Sean and I are going to remind you that this is Pledge Break.
Podcast listeners can give anytime at KUSP.org, another service that we bring you that costs us money, or visit us at KUSP.org. Click on the big blue button.
One of the things that really surprises me every year when we do the pledge drives, I find out what things cost, and I'm always amazed at what things cost. Just to turn on the news, you get into your car and, you know, turn on the news, and there's that little news thing at the top of the hour here on KUSP telling you what's going on in the world, bringing you NPR. Well, we spend $506 a day to bring you the news. That's why we need you to pledge at KUSP.org. We need your help. We pass your membership dollars along to NPR so they can pay for reporters and so they can bring you news from All Things Considered and Marketplace. And with your help, we can keep you connected to these excellent programs. I know that so much of my understanding of politics and the economy comes from these intelligent, well-considered dialogues. So give us a call or go online. Podcast listeners, please go to KUSP.org when you hear this podcast, whenever you hear this podcast, because, you know, time opens up and becomes altered in the podcast world, but we can always use some money. I think we're going to go back to the little science lesson that I have planned for you today. So, the science lesson is about statistics and the difficulty of answering and asking questions, and it's based on that New England Journal of Medicine article around screening mammograms that hit the newspapers and the front pages so much last week. So just to recap, a study came out of Finland where they have a really excellent cancer registry, and they incorporated screening mammograms in the 1990s. And what they looked at was how much of the improvement in mortality statistics from breast cancer could be attributed to the mammograms and how much was due to advances in treatment. And between 1996 and 2010, there have been significant advances in treatment, primarily the use of hormone blocking agents to eliminate estrogen from the bodies of women after they've had breast cancer, such that any residual breast cancer cells that have estrogen receptors that might have snuck out and gotten into a lymph node or a bone or the brain don't get any stimulation and so don't grow big enough before they are overwhelmed, found, and taken out by the immune system. All very good. So in this study, they pooled data, which is part of the problem. And then they looked at, well, if you got a mammogram and were found to have breast cancer, did having had the mammogram make a difference in your survival? And what they found was that there was about a 10% difference in survival in women who had mammograms that found their breast cancer versus those that found their breast cancer by finding the cancer on clinical exam. And of that, they broke it down further using the technique of comparing to the population that was not in the screening program. And they were able to say, well, we think 2% of that 10% is from the mammogram and the other 8% is from the hormone therapy. The World Health Organization data uses a figure of 25% reduction in mortality for breast cancer for mammograms. And that's why it's recommended. This was from the 2002 World Health Organization recommendations. So where the discrepancy? There's a couple of problems with this study that I mentioned last week, but the big problem is that compliance was an issue in this study. So in those women who supposedly had access to screening, only 3/4 of them actually got the screening. So there was 77% compliance, which considering that the mammograms were free and encouraged is pretty interesting to me that 1/4 of the population still didn't do it. The big problem with the study was it has a lag time issue. The average follow-up time
was only 2 years. And if you're going to make a statement about breast cancer mortality, you need at least 7 to 10 years of time, because that's where you're going to see the differences in mortality really be meaningful and something you can put your hand on statistically. So big problem here was that the average follow-up time was only 2 years. And one of the things that comes out when you actually read the study, and that's what I wish the people who wrote the newspaper articles would actually do, don't read the press release, read the study, was that it depended on what stage breast cancer you were in. For example, if you were stage one, very early breast cancer when your breast cancer was found, it didn't matter whether it was found on clinical exam or mammography, you had no difference in mortality between the two groups. If, on the other hand, you were stage two breast cancer, that's a breast cancer that is going to spread. In other words, it's already shown itself to be the type of cancer that can spread and will spread given time. The difference between mammogram screening and non-screening was a whopping 29%. So if you have the kind of breast cancer that's going to kill you, mammograms helped a lot. And in stage three breast cancer, there was no benefit to screening because, as I like to say, that horse done left the barn. The breast cancer has already gotten out into your system at stage three, and it doesn't matter whether it was found by mammogram or found by clinical exam because it's too late to make a difference in your outcome. So what about that? What do you think? I think that we need to read the study before we comment on it. And I just want to pat myself a little bit on the back for remembering to go and pull the article and bring this to you. Let's go to Josh and Salinas. Josh, welcome to the program.
Good morning, doctor. Thanks for the show.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good.
I had a flu shot this week.
Yeah?
And in the papers that I signed, it said this shot contains thimerosal, but you can ask for a shot that doesn't contain one. And I thought, well, Dr. Donna's always said minimize your mercury exposure. So I asked for the preservative-free shot, and they were really nice and accommodating. They didn't charge any extra right away, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, which is great. I'm glad that they had it. The real problem with the preservative-free flu shots is, you know, line up early for your preservative-free flu shots because we're going to run out. We don't have enough to vaccinate the entire population that should be vaccinated. When the vaccination factories, now having figured out that thimerosal is a marketing issue, they are retooling and starting to provide more and more thimerosal-free vaccine. But you don't just build a factory. You build the factory, and then you have to get the FDA to come in and approve every step of your process. And that's like getting permits to build like a second story on your house. You know, how quick does that go in most communities? So there's going to be a lead time in terms of retooling our nation's factories. And I'm not even talking about the capital investment, right? That's a whole other issue. So in the meantime, we still have to rebuild the car while we're driving it. And if you are a person who feels that they're environmentally sensitive, if you've had large mercury exposures in the past, either through an industrial reason or because, you know, you weren't careful in a mercury spill and you think you may have accumulated a body burden, if you've got a ton of amalgam in your mouth, those are the people I'd say go get the preservative-free now, because that won't be around forever. We'll be out probably by December, if not before. Some places are going to run out sooner than others, obviously.
Thank you for clarifying it.
You're very welcome, and wanted to say that I'm glad you got your flu shot. A lot of people seem to be walking away from that this year, and I'm just like, okay, that's stupid. We had, you know, such noise about the flu last year. So as a result, for a number of reasons, we didn't get cold all winter. That was one reason. And another reason was that we did get everybody vaccinated because of all that publicity. So we had a very minimal flu season. And everyone's kind of disappointed, you know, they were ready for the disaster. The disaster didn't happen. So the idea that there could be a disaster has somehow been discredited in people's minds. Get your flu shot, folks. Come on. This is silly. Use your brain.
More fun than the real flu.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Melissa in Marina. Hello, Melissa, and welcome to the program.
Hi there. I've just had an MRI on my right knee, and they found a torn meniscus with some cartilage damage and are recommending arthroscopic surgery.
Of course they are. You have health insurance.
So is it entirely necessary? Is there something that I can do to help strengthen it? Will it really help with the pain and achiness that I feel?
Okay. So first thing, background. How old are you and how athletic are you?
I'm 48. Not terribly athletic, although work-wise I walk probably 3 to 4 miles a day.
All right. And how bothered are you by your current symptoms and how far out are you from the injury?
Injury was the beginning of August. And it depends on the day. Sometimes I'm not bothered at all, and sometimes if I get up quickly, then I...
You get a little twinge.
A little, big, medium twinge.
Medium twinge, okay.
Yeah.
And that lasts a couple seconds, but then it goes away completely, or residual pain for the rest of the day?
Residual pain.
Okay. So, you know, you're kind of a medium, low-grade meniscal injury. You're not collapsing and your knee's not locking, and those are two sets of conditions where I always recommend knee surgery.
Okay.
There's obviously a risk of a fall, and that's a serious meniscal tear when your knee locks or when your knee collapses on you while you're walking. You don't have that. You're not Peekaboo Street, who won an Olympic gold medal. I think she was 2 weeks out from an arthroscopic knee surgery.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I mean, I'm sure she was chock full of steroids as well, but still, it's impressive. I mean, I just mean cortisone in the knee. I'm not saying she was using, you know, anabolics, so let me be clear.
Right.
Don't want a lawsuit or anything. So if I had your knee injury, there's no way I would have surgery. And that's speaking for myself personally. I could live with that. And the chances that I'm going to have a significant improvement in that symptom from having somebody cut on my knee is close to zero.
Really?
Yeah. You're not going to get much better from the surgery, much faster than you would on your own, in my opinion. You will not, this is scientific, this is not even my opinion, you will not avoid arthritis or have any difference in your outcome 5 years from now. You will either have knee pain or you won't 5 years from now. You will either have arthritis in 2 decades or you won't.
Yeah, he said that there was some arthritis. And
it's not going to make any difference at all to have surgery.
And he was talking about, well, this could prevent you from having a total knee replacement sooner rather than later.
There's absolutely no data for that. That is a sales pitch.
Okay.
Okay, so... It's a nice sales pitch, and I wish it were true, but there is absolutely nothing objective to support that.
So what should I do to continue the low-grade exercise and walking and over-the-counter?
Yeah, and, you know, you're local, so go see one of the gazillion fine acupuncturists we've got around. Acupuncture works great for this level of knee injury.
Okay.
You need anti-inflammatory therapy and some time.
Okay.
And acupuncture is a good anti-inflammatory therapy.
Alrighty. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to another email. This one is quite interesting, from Robert in Salt Lake City. Robert's a podcast listener, evidently. Dear Dr. Don, I've never heard you talk about medical ethics, but IMHO Hospice recently discussed is easy prey for the greedy. My wife has advanced Alzheimer's. Last neuropsych exam in 1998 when she was 49, at which time she was bottom 1%. On the cognitive test. At the present time, she has only primitive reflexes. I'm so sorry to hear that, Robert. My observation is that hospice has attracted many that are looking for an easy buck. They'll put someone like my wife, who is in an Alzheimer's residential facility, on hospice. Then they send a nurse and aides to feed and bathe her, which staff is already paid to do. The hospice folks get big money for doing the same thing. They go through the motions without providing any substantive benefit. The bilking continues until the person dies or somebody decides the person is not dying fast enough and removes the services. In my wife's case, hospice was first suggested 7 years ago and has been suggested a couple of times in the last month. She is being well cared for and is not a candidate for hospice. On the other hand, I'm all for hospice sending someone out to help when a spouse is the full-time 24/7 caregiver with no help or being overburdened. I have an internet friend that is 24/7 caregiver for his wife and is able to leave the house only 3 hours per week. She is bedbound, having only primitive reflexes, and the hospice was stopped because she was not dying fast enough. This population is underserved and could use the support being frittered away by the greedy taking advantage of the system. I believe that putting this shameful activity in the limelight is all that is needed to fix it. Thanks and regards, an avid Ask Dr. Don fan. Well, what an interesting perspective Robert has. And I will say that most hospice situations in our local area are people who are in the home receiving hospice care. I think it's very important to reflect that. But to the circumstances where people are willing to take advantage of a government-funded situation, and there is always someone willing to do that, you will see abuses. How you deal with those abuses is, of course, at the regulatory level, via inspections, and by pulling the certification from hospices that do inappropriate certifications. And, you know, that does happen and has not happened to any of our local hospices here. But I can't speak for your area. And definitely there's Medicare fraud out there. And it becomes, well, once a culture comes up that says, take the money, and everybody is taking the money, then if you move into that area, you get altered by the culture and feels a fool for not taking the money. And we have a lot of local culture in medicine, some of it good, some of it bad. One of the great challenges we have right now is trying to figure out how to encourage good behavior and discourage bad behavior without creating an undue burden on everybody for certification documentation, which, believe me, the documentation burdens are a really good way to waste money. Interesting study that came out, and I guess this caught my eye because I have been running across psilocybin, the magic mushroom drug, a lot lately. I had a patient a couple of weeks ago who brought to my attention some research that's being done on cluster headache, showing that psilocybin has effects in eliminating or breaking cluster headaches. And you can find information about that on a very good website called clusterbusters.com. So if you're one of those people who suffers from that, there's a lot of good information on that website. This study was actually looking at terminal cancer patients. And the one good thing about terminal cancer patients is because they're terminal, there is a sense that it's okay to do human experimentation on them, and there's a motivation on the part of the patient to volunteer because there's no long-term risk for them if something coming up 5-10 years from now, because they don't have 5 or 10 years, and it's their chance to do something for science, to do something for others, to maybe help other people with cancer. So people do often sign up for studies simply for that reason, and I want to thank everyone who does that. This study looked at 12 cancer patients who were all in advanced stage cancer and anxious and fearful. They ranged in age from 36 to 58, and they went through two sessions, one in which they were given the drug psilocybin, and another when they were given the drug niacin, which provokes a physiological reaction, so they felt like they'd had something. The patients didn't know which drug they were getting, and about 80% of the patients thought that they could tell which one they had, so it wasn't good blinding. But what they did was they put the patients in bed after giving them the dose of psilocybin, and they used a very low dose, 0.2 milligrams per kilogram. They were encouraged to listen to music, wear eye shades, and then they were tested over the course of 6 months, if they lived that long. And for at least 2 weeks, all patients had a significant improvement in mood and a decrease in depression and anxiety. So everybody got a 2-week benefit from this small dose of psilocybin. In the people where they were able to measure it at the 6 months distance, there was still an improvement in depression and anxiety. There was also a decreased need for narcotic pain relievers, which reached statistical significance and was a long term, and there were no adverse reactions. So could psychotherapy have worked just as well? Well, maybe. But the important thing here is that there is a time and a place to use things like medical marijuana, medical hallucinogens, to explore whether the lives of terminal patients can be made better. You know, I think that's a good permitted use, and I just don't see that a slippery slope argument makes a lot of sense. So let's just take one more quick story. This one about baby sleep positioners. Several safety groups just came online saying that there are these little nursery things that are supposed to keep babies on their backs to keep them from rolling over onto their stomachs, because we've associated the lying on your stomach with crib death. Well, it turns out that these devices, these baby sleep positioners, actually have been responsible for at least 13 deaths on their own when the baby rolls over and smothers on the pillow. So get those things out of the crib right now. And in terms of getting into the crib, I hear Sean shuffling papers, which means we have people to thank.
We sure do. Hans and Anna Marie, Dr. Don, and geeks. They love Car Talk. They think you're fantastic, Dr. Don. Rhea in Ben Lomond, another Dr. Don fan, and an anonymous caller in Santa Cruz, and Anne in Santa Cruz.
And let's remember that we are strong. We are fine. We are going to be okay. And that is not just we, the station. That is everybody. If we decide that we are going to be okay, then we have just tripled the chances that we're going to be okay. We affect the odds of the outcome by our attitude, whether that's in terms of your approach to a disease process, whether that's your approach to your homework, whether that's your approach to a pledge drive. It is absolutely true. Attitude makes a huge difference. So public radio's past, present, and future is in the hands of the community. This is local radio by local people, for local people, and funded of local people.
Mm-hmm.
So with the internet, that locality concept gets distributed more widely. It becomes a community not of location, but a community of interest. So please, please, please go to KUSP.org. And thank you very much to Sean Ramaswaran for being here to pitch with me. Thank you, Sean.
And thanks to everyone who called this hour.
This is Dr. Don for now saying so long and stay healthy.